David, whether you have a few weeks old puppy or a senior who's seen multiple decades, any dog person like me knows the most valuable thing in the world is spending time with your pet.
Yep.
The farmer's dog makes it easy to keep them healthy, which can give you more quality years with your lovely dog.
Yeah, well, I've heard Farmer's Dog makes and delivers fresh, healthy dog food. And, you know, that's what everyone's looking for. It's recommended by vets, nutritionally balanced. It's made from human-grade ingredients, safe, clean kitchens. All that stuff matters.
Yeah. I mean, you love your dog. Why get the lousy food for your dog? Farmer's Dog is the best. Traditional dry and wet dog food options are extremely processed.
Sometimes
they use
dogs...
much lower quality. Yeah.
you put it in their bowl and they go, what is this kibble? And they knock it away. What is this canned goo?
Oh, yeah. I've had our dog, yeah, look at the bowl and then kind of crank its neck up and look at me. And it was like, really?
They go, really? Why don't you go first? You want a bite of this? Slop?
And it makes that sound.
Here you go, dog.
So Farmer's Dog isn't just higher quality food. They also send the food pre-portioned specifically for your dog based on their unique nutritional needs. It makes it easy to help your dog reach and stay at their ideal weight, David, and which is one of the biggest indicators of a full, healthy life. A fresh diet has been found to have all sorts of benefits, David, from healthier coat and skin, better breath, if you want to kiss your dog, and even easier digestion and smaller and better poops.
Let's look at a clip. It doesn't matter if your dog's young or old, it's always the right time to invest in their health for more happy years with your dog. Get 50% off your first box at farmersdog.com/fly.
Let the Farmer's Dog know we sent you. Use your code or click podcast after you sign up for your first box.
Oh, I was saying that when Rob and I were there for the four shows, I think what we don't realize, even though we didn't get a sketch on in quotes, but being at the rewrite table and being around the office, you can just tell if you're in the game that long, like they were, just by saying we're pitching throwaway jokes in sketches on rewrites. I think just hearing someone talk at lunch or dinner or hearing pitches, by the end, you can go, they've got game or not. Like they can tell, like just from what I heard, the little bits, we're on the right track with these guys. Cause I'm sure they went to Downey Lauren and said, what do you think? Do you want these two clowns back? And then, you know, Smigel or Frank and Chirp.
I'll tell you something that's important as well. And that, and especially Lauren, like he wants to hire people he can go to dinner with.
Yeah.
He wants to hire people that really have a high social IQ in the room. And you two qualify for that. As far as integrating in with everybody, you guys had a lot of charm and you wouldn't over talk. You'd insert, you know, and so that... Yeah. Part of the reason you're there, besides your great comedy chops, was just social skills. And Lauren really picks up on that, you know?
Yeah.
You get along well. And I just want to say, I'm going to tear up, but Rob, who wrote Il Cantore? Because that,
okay, well,
was
that
one of my favorite moments I ever did on the show, and I did not
write it. I will tell
you,
that was influenced by an experience that Adam and I had. Well, we, first of all, I went over to, it's a weird thing, but like money... How I equate success, you know, is something like my parents, when they spent money on a couch, they bought a new couch and they immediately covered it in this quality, high, thick polyurethane plastic. And they wouldn't let, when they still wouldn't let us sit on it. Because it was a really nice couch.
Oh, you couldn't?
So
that makes sense.
Like,
yeah, I got
so
that.
So that was like, you know, we have money for a couch now. Don't fuck it up. This is our couch. Don't spill shit
never
on it.
Never sit on it.
Don't spill
it. Don't even look at it.
These are for guests. And when the guests come over, and if they're special guests, we'll unzip the plastic. So that's the way I equate, like, you know, fame and success as a couch. So I went over to Adam Sandler.
Well, how do you connect that?
I don't get it yet.
Unzipping the plastic?
We're getting there.
Unzipping. So I went over an unzipped brand new couch at Adam's. I said, he must be making money. This is a new couch. It was like a little... couch. And I said, so we started, you know, by the second season, we're making a little bit of money. So then we had girlfriends too, which is another sign of success. One of the reasons, well, let's be honest, we really wanted to get in the show business because I like, you know, when I played trombone in the marching band and in high school, I said, this is not
going to
get
dropper.
Me a supermodel. This is not going to anywhere close. I said, what is it going to do? What can I do better than this? So stand
for,
up.
For a second, for the Lonely Hearts Club that I was part of, once you are forced to act confident, stand on a platform and dominate a room, even if you're just pretending, your stock goes up with young girls. So it is Xanadu. It is
I like a certain comedian like Norm MacDonald, like, you know, yeah, you got about 45 minutes to close the deal when you're done. Because, you know, the women, the power, it depreciates after you're on stage. I said, Jesus, this guy's like a scientist about getting laid after getting on stage.
Well, the power move is at the other cafe where this girl that you couldn't even talk to in high school is flirting with you, and then they're announcing your name. I gotta go.
Yeah,
you know. Oh, but anyway, go back to your story. Sorry about that.
So, anyways, I'm at Adam Sandler's place. He's got a new couch, and I go, "Well, we've changed."
Nice.
And then we have girlfriends, good looking girlfriends, and all of a sudden, so we go to a place that we wouldn't have gone the first season because I remember like he had his dad knew somebody who had like a so he had like a couple of months for the first time, the first season at SNL, just in case it's not, you know, wasn't work out above this restaurant on Madison Avenue. And it was a little apartment that he got for like the, you know, for a few months. And I remember the place was so expensive downstairs. It was like the turkey sandwich was $17. And
he said, "What the fuck?"
I said, "We'll split a turkey." I said, "You and I will we'll split a turkey sandwich." Yeah. And then we'll eat downstairs. And it's one of those fancy places. So you kind of, it's cool to hang out there. So by the time we started making a little bit of money, the second season, we take the girlfriends, we go to Little Italy, let's show off a little bit. And these Italian guys were kissing the girls.
There we go. Okay,
how are you?
Oh, they're kissing your girlfriends.
They say, "Bellissima."
Kissing your girlfriend.
They're kissing
your
girlfriend.
In front of you.
Yeah. Yes, they're kissing them and kissing up and down. And you know, and the hug also seemed like, you know, the hug was also very, you know.
Familiar.
Yeah. Yes, it was like, and they just
welcome.
Met them. And we go like, well, you know, we're happy to be here, but it was a little odd. But
yeah.
That sunk in something really to Adam's psyche about that. And I remember he went off... and I had a great office on the 17th floor that actually you could see the Empire State Building. It's like, nice. This is ridiculous. This is incredible.
Yeah, it's all
how did I get
it's
this?
It's all incredible.
It's amazing. Yeah. So, and then just being on the 17th floor and go like, who did Aykroyd have this office? I was always, the history of the show. And then, so Adam came in with Robert Smigel and they can't talk. And they're literally like, it's 2:00, 2:30 in the morning. Just
I was
when,
about
when
to say,
good,
it's got to be him and Smigel.
That's when the good stuff starts to come because the structural side of your brain gets really, really tired and the
so
goofy
tired.
Side
yeah.
takes over.
Yeah.
And so these guys are coming in and they're literally giggling and just falling over. And they just literally hand me this pieces of paper. And it was typed at that time. So they got it typed and then they handed it to me and they're watching me and I'm reading the sketch. Bellissima! Where they're the kissing and Italian restaurant. They watch me. They watch me just to make sure that they weren't just being goofy
crazy.
Themselves.
Yeah.
Then they watched me, and I reading it, and I fell on the floor, rolling, laughing. Mm-hmm. And they said, "We got something here."
Goddamn.
And then Adam and I, you know, we know that Dana was gonna murder.
Yeah, you have to bring in the big guns.
Dana would have another level of commitment. Which is like there was a level of commitment. You expect this, and then Dana would just go off.
It was pennies from heaven for me because you have to write a lot of stuff. But when you get something handed to you,
that's a crusher.
It's physically funny and in every other way funny.
You almost remember. So it's for people. It's one of the most famous sketches in our era. There where the Italian waiters are kissing and then you know. You being one of the Italian waiters, you come by and you lick Kirstie Alley's face. She was a gamer. She's what I call a broad.
She was great.
She
I
loves
licked
that.
The shit out of her face. I said, "Are you okay with this?" She goes, "Oh yeah." And so I was like, making a meal.
She knew
out of her
she
face.
Was in a fucking crusher
she
sketch.
He's very cool.
And then Adam is like, you know, we shared a dressing room for years, and. He said, and he looked at me, and he's a bit of a hairy guy, and he's got one of those hockey legs, you know, like the northeasterner kind of guy.
Yeah,
you know,
just
like,
hairy
he's got a hockey
legs.
Ass, you know. He should be playing, and he's actually
chunky.
A pretty good skater. Yeah,
yeah,
you know, he's actually like we during like the second season. I remember we're walking to go to get something to eat, and it was snow in the street, and he would like run out. And during a stop, when there was a stoplight, and he'd get behind a cab and sneak behind a cab, and he'd let the cab pull him.
And have his shoes on the ice?
Just his tennis shoes on the ice.
Oh, yeah.
And then he would like...
Oh,
and then
he'd, shoes,
and then, but he wouldn't... He would handle it. And be just good skater. good guy. And I went like, shit.
Yeah.
And I said, dude, you're famous. You're going to get, you know, you're going to get smashed.
He didn't need anything extra going on. He already had everything going on.
Yeah. So then,
so then he also can do that.
And then he asked me, he says, wait, and he said, should I shave my pubes? And I went, absolutely. And I just knew it was going to grow back and he was going to be in agony for a couple of weeks and I was going to enjoy that. And yeah, so he's preparing, he's got this like diaper on before. And he just blew,
oh, shave the pubes for the
and,
bit.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. he's there before, not we're in the dressing you. Room. And he said, should I shave my pubes for the Italian waiters bit? Because he comes out in a diaper basically with his ass hanging out. And I said, absolutely, yeah. Adam. Yeah. Shave yeah. the shit out of that. And then he did. And then, and I came out and I was ass naked. And that was when the censor, who was the time in our era?
Andrew Brewer.
Andrew Brewer said, yes. Please don't show your ass. Please, please, I beg you, I'll get fired. Please, 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 I beg you. Because then they were laughing so hard, when, especially when you were humping Victoria
well, how,
Jackson.
I want to ask from your point of view about that, because how did we get to that? Where I go as the waiter, I lick Kirstie's face, I do a la la la, I go back, and somehow Victoria and I are having some debate or something, then I lean her down on the table. Did I do that in the dress show?
No.
I didn't.
You didn't.
Okay.
You, what happened was, like, a lot of times, you take something, oh, this is funny, let's do it more and more.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the dress rehearsal, it was screamingly funny. Mm-hmm. And then it was another level. And then Farley also was, like, was humping the window at the end.
Yeah.
So it was a thing. And then it was one of the-
I forgot Farley yeah, was in. Farley.
One of the few sketches, and the biggest tag of any sketch I was ever involved in was usually, you don't have a good ending for something.
Right.
But Kevin Nealon, who was the date of Kirstie Alley, said, let's go to a- hey, this is too much. Let's go to the this is a Greek restaurant down the street,
yeah, so.
Which is like, oh my God. And it was a screaming laugh at the end. Mm-hmm. I remember being 4 feet away from you, four mm-hmm. feet away from Adam. And we're looking at each other with that slight little grin. Because I never liked being one of those guys who ever broke. I never broke. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just didn't respect it. It wasn't part of the tradition of mm-hmm. the SNL. And I know that they did after we left or after my years there.
You're not allowed not to laugh.
But I looked at him and there was a look on our face like, we couldn't hear each other do our lines.
Yeah.
But we knew it so well that we like, it's just murdering. Like, especially when I came out, it was a scream when I came out because I showed my ass came out.
Are you, you know? Yeah. You come out naked.
I came
but
out naked.
But you came out so sensorial and so straight and so no sense your ass is hanging out. You're just, you're bare and you're just acting so regular.
It yes. Was just that was a, that was something that the audience had never
no
had,
winking
hadn't seen
at
it.
All.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is so good to not comment on.
Yeah. Nothing.
And just commit to the stuff, you know, which mm-hmm. was what you need to do. But there's a little bit of you're enjoying it also.
It's always behind the eyes. When I had Victoria's legs in the air and I'm having a kind of an argument with you guys. What are you doing? What and that's going, and I can't really even hear myself. The audience is roaring because of the visual of it. Victoria, of course, was such a gamer.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a perfect part for her. So you guys wrote and produced a perfect sketch, basically.
That one was the best one. I mean, there were some that were...
some just stand out.
Some just like, well, that was... There are things that are you can't deny.
You know the term Airbnb?
Yeah.
What's good is if, like, I have a place... And I don't. There's a place I don't stay in mm-hmm. as much, and so my first thought is, I should Airbnb this thing because then you make a few beans in your jeans, and you can go off and you know maybe buy something you wanted to mm-hmm. buy while you're not using.
That's like that's earning money while you sleep, using your home as an Airbnb. I have it sounds so bourgeois, an extra home kind of someplace, and so. It might make a really good Airbnb, seriously.
It's not a bad idea because, you know, it's easy and then people come in, they go, you make a little cash, you move on. I mean, you travel a lot, I travel a lot. It's good for us. You know, you can Airbnb your house here and then go somewhere and do it.
And that's the thing is you have so much flexibility. You could do it just during the summer months or just do weekends. I mean, you're in complete control. And then you make, as you call, the beans. While you go do other things.
Right. Like, let's say you know you're going to take a trip for a family reunion every year. You can plan ahead, take that week, and Airbnb your place.
Mm-hmm. There's no holes in this theory right here. You know, if you have a seasonal house.
Got to try it out. Listen, your place might be worth more than you think. You got to check in. You find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
another thing that a little gem that the great Dana Carvey gave me. He was because you're frustrating. You don't know how the business is. I didn't know anyone in it. My mom was a was a teacher, war survivor. My dad had his own trauma in his youth. You know, there's a suicide. His father committed suicide. So I was raised with. I didn't know anything. I had very fragile parents who were also really, really had a violent streak. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, and I don't know. But Dana gave me this thing because you have this fire in you. But it's like I tell my own kids, I said, like, and I got luckily beautiful little kids, and I said, you got a fire in you. Fire is very instructive. It can cook your dinner, but it can also burn the house down. You know, and Danny said, very instructive to me. I never forgot. It's one of the things that you keep going. That
shit. What did I say?
No,
exactly?
You said you don't have to let people know how hungry you are.
Mm-hmm.
That was informative. Because it's like, I want this fucking thing so bad. And oh, look at these. It's like, calm down. Said, and then you said, get so good they can't deny you.
I remember that.
You still may not get the job.
Yeah.
But get so good they can't deny it. And then they go, well, that guy's amazing. That guy's great, but we got to hire the more famous guy. And that keeps you going for
because
years.
Because of the club drama. When you're starting out in clubs, a lot of drama, and you can get into the drama with the dysfunctional comics. I should be a headliner. I don't know why I got that. And just look at your own feet, stay in your lane, and just become undeniable.
Who takes you aside and gives you that kind of information?
Yeah, it's nice.
And then also the witness to it. Like, I said, we had a great drive down to LA one time, stayed at your apartment, and I was like, well, this is beautiful. This is going to be my future. I'll move down here. This is going to be amazing. I love it.
SF guys going to LA.
I love it. And he's like, no, this. And then, like, and I remember it's like you were on that TV show where they, like, clearly the most, you know, I said, this is the most talented guy I know, and they don't know how to use him. Yeah. And they let you have 5 minutes to do whatever you wanted at the end of that TV series, which where you played a helicopter pilot.
Oh, that, yeah.
And well, I was like,
Blue Thunder.
I
never should have done that stuff. That was my own
insecurity.
But
that's just getting a job. You got to get a
job. Like, because I was so, they wanted to have me do a TV show. I did quit after that. I just focused on stand-up for the last 2 years before SNL.
But it was really informative, too. I said, well, if they can't, he's the most talented guy I know. Yeah. Most talented guy out of San Francisco. This is the guy. And it said, like, and if he's having a problem here, what the hell am I worried about? And that actually was very informative as well. So, well, this shit, it's hard. And so that's why when you do 1,000 auditions like we did, you know, and like the thing about what was cool about Spade was he had already done a movie. And that was like amazing.
Right. Police Academy.
That was like an enigma in a you know.
It's crazy. I was already on set for 10 weeks, but you know, Robbie, we got the balls you had was when things were cooking quicker for you. You got offered a movie and you said no. I think it was the one with Michael J. Fox in New Zealand, The Frighteners.
And it was also with Peter Jackson. I should have said yes, but this script was terrible.
I think it was $300,000. I was like,
it was his first American movie. But it was called Abracadaver, which is like, oh my God, that sounds like a career ender.
That's the great,
But it wasn't a great, but no, like, I would have.
No, it was, I think, $300,000 because I was more torn up by it than you were. I was like, he's turning the fucking ball. But you also had the balls, right?
I did some shitty
ones,
though,
too. You wrote Copy Machine when we were just being told every day, don't put yourself in two lines.
Well, that was the
thing.
And
then you wrote your own sketch, and I was like, the balls. And then it got on, and I was like, wait, that's even possible?
Well, that's the dangling carrot, because like when Lauren hired us.
That was too good to,
Lauren would
it's
say
a
like,
little vague, right?
He said like, I said, but I want to be a performer. I said, we're going to hire you.
That'll
said,
come.
We're going to hire you as a writer, like a group, but we're going to hire you as a writer. Because that's what happened. After I didn't meet with him because I went and do a $75 gig and shit my pants. Like,
San Diego.
Then I freaked out. And then I really got nervous because then they flew us back to New York and we had to perform for the writers at Catch. And, you know, they didn't laugh once in the whole time. They just want to see if you're going to get shaken.
That's it. Lauren, when I was, he pushed me a little bit. Do you have anything else or is it just that? I mean, he literally tried to shake me, not at the club. He saw me at a club, but at the little audition. So yeah, that is a show
that rattles
when you don't give it up. You don't.
Yeah, but there was a thing about, like, remember when the ears burning off my face? I was saying, I remember at that point I had to say to myself, okay, you just got annihilated physically, emotionally, spiritually, in every way you can. And I said, you can't, I just said to myself, you cannot let this get to you. And I said, I'm willing to let them get to me till here. And it was like my belt. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to let this affect me here, but not all the way to my feet. I'm not going to let that happen.
Not my
and
dick.
So like when I was eating it that night, just get through this, man. Get through this. They saw you be funny the other day. Just get through it. Get through it. And I walked out of there, and I was shaken by it, but not broken. And that was the key, because on live TV, you can't shake. No. You can't be broken. You got to stand in there and do it. And it's just the repetitive nature of it, and just getting steely and getting tough. And then to the other level, to enjoy it.
That's where you want to get to, and that took me a little time to truly enjoy it.
And then also to deal with the pressure of it. I mean, because that is that's why, like, when we first got there, I remember you and I looking like, what is everybody complaining about? It's the greatest thing ever. Mm. And like 4 years later, it's like, boy, it does wear you down.
Sure.
100-hour weeks.
It's like a dream come true. When you got Copy Machine Guy, what was that feeling? Because then you get on the show.
Well, when you get there and you see, like, wow.
Something's popping.
These people get onto restaurants quicker than me. Like, you got Phil Harp and you got Dana Carvey. You get these murderers row up there.
Yeah.
And then, but you also know, like, I know I can get this, and if I just got to get on there. And then, you know, then I remember when the first year, it was late. In 1990 when Adam Sandler was hired. Mm. And this is a guy, and it was so cute because his first week was there, we wrote a sketch together. And I said, come on, I'll show you how it's done. Like, I know, I've been there before shows by then. And then he stayed up all night, and his little eyes were puffy. And we wrote this thing for ourselves. And then—
Still had the big legs though.
Yeah,
I want a picture, Adam.
And we wrote it, and then they took it away from us, and then gave it to, like, was going to be I think it was Goodman and Hartman. And they said, like, I said, what do we have to, in a gentle way, what do we have to do to get on ourselves here? And it was very instructive too. He said, when you could perform something, when you write something that you could perform better than other people, then we'll get it on. And I said, okay, bingo, I'll come up with something. And I liked writing for other people because I enjoyed also the thrill of, like, when you performed a piece that was probably the best one I had ever written for any piece, and you had a way of, like, you would, like, it was like the wave, a really great comedian, as opposed to, like, a sketch player maybe could do it too, but a comedian in a big room can ride the wave, and before it's coming down, you know, three quarters, two quarters, no one to come in with that other line. And it was a massive hairy head wound.
Oh,
did you write that?
You're kind of the main architect of that sketch.
I wrote that. Well, with Adam, but that was me.
Well, double thanks, because I was riding a rocket in that. And of course, what we talked about in the podcast, the dog thing at the end was, you can't beat a dog going dog.
But the thing about it was the dog in dress rehearsal.
Yes. What did you guys do?
With the dog in dress rehearsal, we said, okay. Well, we can't have it rabid, but, like, they said to us, you know, and I don't know anything about dogs, and they just said, well, if we don't feed it, it's going to, you know, it'll get to do what we want by the time. And anyway, so they fed it a little bit, so it was curious.
It was curious at
dress. And it was absolutely famished.
Did you put more, was it baby food you put on the prostate?
It was liver baby food.
Liver baby food.
We put on, I fucking put it on, and I caked on there.
I tried,
and
it was good.
And you did a beautiful thing where, like, because it was literally ripping off the side of your head, which was a wig, prosthetic with a
bloody wound.
The dog went for it. Basically, a massive hairy wound.
It wanted it on air. It wanted it.
Massive hairy head wound was a guy who should not be at a party, who's at a party, and just with a big head wound.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, is getting, everybody is just like, he's trying to normalize it, which is great. Somebody, a crazy person in a room, in a situation where you've never
been. To treat you normally.
And then he's got this giant head wound. They're reacting, and he's like, this is a punch bowl, and there's a thing. And then at the end, there's
I take a nap.
Take a nap, and the dog goes to town. And it was one of those things where you're watching it, and it's just, it's going really good, and you're just like, oh God, come on, please keep going.
Get to this.
And then when the dog literally
went to get it
because it knew where it was and was hungry. Mm-hmm. And then you do this beautiful thing where you snuck your hand up on the other side to hang on.
To hold it. And I was in a death struggle with that dog.
And you were also, because there was, like, your right eye
was stretching.
What you were, like, 4 inches away from this very hungry dog. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of rode it. And then you had the wherewithal to remember to let the audience, as that screaming laugh was coming down, to throw in that, like,
yeah,
he smells my dog.
I think he must smell my dog.
Yeah. But you had to almost yell it.
Yeah, I had to kind of yell it. And the thing was, is back to our generation of not breaking, the sketch went so beautifully, I did not want it to be about the prosthetic coming off.
Yeah.
So by consequence, the battle extended so long that, and I heard someone, Lauren watching the monitor, which always, we always want to make Lauren helpless, and it was helpless with laughter. But anyway, Rob, what can I do for you? I mean, those are
you
two.
Dude, it's the least I can do to pay you back for all you did for me.
Two great gifts.
When you do, Rob and I both had this problem where you're writing that first year, even second year for me, and you're putting your stuff in even smaller parts, and they go, give that to Dana, give it to Mike Myers, give it to, and you have to keep taking yourself out. So the one way in is update, because you're by yourself, you can try to get something on.
That was Sandler's key, was the Eddie Murphy route.
Especially the guitar you got
and
up
And your copy machine, but I think the host was Sting the first time you did it.
Well, the first time I did it was with Joe...
Pesci?
No, Joe...
Mantegna.
And I remember it was so crushed because I finally had a monster. It was one of the things I said when Jim Downey noticed this is a kind of like a goofy, too happy to be here kind of attitude, was this. And and he said, you got to do a character called the Lurker. It kind of got this hanging around. But truthfully, and I gave him credit, but the copy machine guy had nothing to do with that, really. Mm-hmm. It was just a guy, the really came from when we first got there to SNL. Mm. Remember before we got the really good office? Mm. There were so many cast members, I think 17 at the time.
That
we were
first time a really big cast.
There was a giant cast where literally the crawl of the show was actually longer than like the monologue. Yeah. Because it was like 17. And also, and this, and Coaster, and the feature player. It was like Ellen Claghorn, and David Spade, and Rob Schneider, and Adam Sandler. It went on, and Melanie Hussle. And, so we were in like half an office.
Yeah.
And I had the cooling and heating vent in mine. So it was either boiling or freezing in there. So I have claustrophobia because I have two older brothers and put me in sleeping bags and closets my childhood. So like I can't stand in closed place. I hate it. And so I would go out into the main writer's room. And I noticed when everyone's walking back and forth, you can't be as excited the fourth and fifth time when to see, Kevin Nealon. So Kevin was the one I said, Kevin, all right. Kevin. Right. Kevin.
Just your doors open.
And he came and played with the idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you want, buddy? What's Kevin, And that was it. It was like, and I said, I had to come up. And then I went to New Orleans for the weekend just to take off some pressure. And I thought like, well, there's got to be a reason why people would come into contact with this annoying person. And they didn't want to put him somewhere else. And I just can't, that's a copy machine.
Copies.
That was it. Simple, but I remember like people were laughing so hard at read through, which was like, to me, there's no such thing as a democracy in show business, but that was the most democratic thing I've ever experienced. Yeah. If you wrote a sketch, it was read in front of everybody.
Right. And
that is pretty damn amazing. So if you murdered with everybody, chances are
usually that's good. And I think that, I would use the word inexplicability, like making copies. It's all not a punchline. It's all the absurdity and the rhythm to it. But it's also just kind of a nerd in an office leaning back, trying to be friendly. I mean, it works on a lot of levels.
And
did you
big,
comb your hair
smile.
Up in kind of a funny way? Or
I always had
my
hair big by that time because it was just like funny Elvis-y. Elvis-y. And he's like, he was a guy that you also, he's kind of gentle and nobody wanted to hurt his feelings, but he's also annoying. And so it was a nice combination of this vulnerability.
Smiling.
Yeah. Vulnerability is a big one.
Likeability.
Yeah.
And then people, and I remember that, like, cause I did it with Joe Mantegna, and they said, we're going to cut it
save
for
it?
Time. We're going to save it. And I went like, save it.
Terrifying.
It's my chance. I've waited all these years. I'm 25. I got to make it now.
Who's this guy? The guy who wants to make it guy?
But how would you not give it to the host? I mean, always the trick is if you write something for the host, that's the best
usually,
shot.
They knew that. Well, if you could perform it better, and that sing-songiness to it.
Yeah, I mean, man,
the rhythm
I don't know if it's
the
perfect guy for that.
Right. So when did it first kill? Who was the host?
Sting.
Sting. Well, he's got all
that came out of the gate.
Yeah.
And people got into the rhythm early into that sketch.
When was
the
first
third line?
Third time?
The third line, Kevin. And they said, hey, what's going on? It's like, all right, Kevin, asking me questions. Kevinator. Kevin. And that one.
Oh,
they laughed.
The second one, Kevin.
Kevin. Yeah. There's no new information happening.
It was Sting.
Continuing to
Sting
like,
Sting looked like a fucking star.
Yeah, right. That's
it
exactly
is. That's
right.
Like a little song, and then there you can laugh.
And then they found a spot for it. And then I remember, the great Jim Downey took me aside and said, it's the only time, like, they hadn't done it very often in that show where, like, except for, the, you're... the weight of you having to open every show for years mm-hmm. was they said, we're going to do another one of those. They said, we have a very, very rare thing here, a character that that people love. And I said, it was a very rare, very the rarest of things here. And I said, we're going to do another one. And then he had the idea of the copy machine breaking down. And that was the best one we ever did.
Oh, I remember.
And that was phenomenal. That was like, because he got to see his whole world crushed. You know, the copy machine.
How does he react to that?
Oh, he's just like, well, they're taking the machine out. Yeah. There's no reason for him. No one to have contact with him anymore. His world is taken apart. Yeah.
So what does he say? You're sad.
You know, it's just, he just got crushed. And then they brought it back in, but you got to see him just like devastated.
Yeah.
And I just remember laughing. But when the first time we did it, the read through, Jim was dying laughing because of the rhythm. Mm-hmm. It was a rhythm of a rhythm of a rhythm.
Yeah.
And that by the time it was like, and there was just a pummeling of it. Mm-hmm. And he was dying laughing. And I said,
great to make Jim laugh.
Yeah. This is the one that's going to get on. And Jim would give it up. That was the key to it. He was interested in us as young guys and I think fed off the energy. But also, if he found something funny, he was very generous. You know, that wasn't always the case with people, you know, because, you know, like, you know, Jay Leno was another influence. Like when Bob Fischer mm-hmm. was a manager, he said, and I was a young comedian, he said, you're going to pick up Jay Leno. He's got a gig in San Jose. You're going to take him to the radio. And I know, you know, San Francisco, you grew up here. You're going to, you know, like the back of your hand, take him wherever he wants to go. So Jay Leno, which is a great Jay Leno story. That's an old one. You got to hear this one. But so I pick up Jay, says, have
Jay's,
a sign.
Jay's very wise.
Nice, clean car. Yeah. And so, you know, he picked him and said, hey, so you drive me to the gang. Yeah. I said, yeah, okay. I mean, you know. So we're driving, and I'm not saying anything. I'm just driving mm-hmm. there. And he said, you know a good Chinese restaurant? I said, I know the best, Mr. Leno. So I took him to the place that my dad knew was like for wealthy people where they would go. We would go to a different place. He said, just as good food, not as expensive, just as good as that place. So I took him to that place, you know. And he said, well, come on and eat. Why don't I eat by myself, you know? And because I wasn't going to go and sit with him, but he did. And he said, so what, are you a comedian? And I said, yes.
Embarrassing.
I said, well, how much time you have? I said, I got about 8 minutes. He said, good. You know, most comedians ask how much time. I got 2 hours. Who wants to hear 2 hours of comedy material? You either have 5 minutes of kills every time, everywhere you go, any place, or you don't have anything.
He's right.
That's what you got to get.
That's
and
true.
So he said, work on it. So I spent the next 6 months just only trying to get that killer five, and that was really mm-hmm. helpful. But the Jay Leno story, which is really funny, around that time, he was doing this bit on Letterman call. What's your beef, Jay?
What's your beef?
Let me tell you my beef.
Yeah,
let me tell
hilarious.
You the beef. And he would do this bit, and it was a monster. You know, like you and I opened for him.
Yes, I've
opened. In 1985.
The two of us?
Both of us.
Okay. Because I did open for him a few times.
I was the opening act. You would come in, and you did a half, and then he did an hour.
Okay.
And we both sat back and went like, wow, this guy just got it. So we have our killer bits. This guy has every bit is a killer bit.
Yes.
That's what we said to each other. We were watching. It was at the Palace of Fine Arts.
Palace of Fine Arts. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And he was like a professional comedian in the sense that every bit would flow to the next bit. And
crafted.
He was tagging his McDonald's. Hey, McDonald's trainee. How do you be a McDonald's trainee? Let me get the milkshake for you. You know, and it was all killing.
And it was like, you got to hand that Buick, 1955 Buick, into the kind of car. You run into a Toyota, you just hose it off. You run into it, you hose it off. Then you go, you keep driving.
And he's smoking a pipe backstage. And I got off maybe before he went
on. A pipe?
He always had a pipe in the early days. And goes, hey, you need more junks, Mr. Cobby. He was kind of right, because I'm just doing chopping broccoli. So I assume Jay would be like, you know, yeah, any more jokes? You know? So,
but he right. And he rode a motorcycle onto the stage.
You bought broccoli.
Yeah, he always was on a motorcycle.
Motorcycle onto the stage.
You bought broccoli. That's
there's
it.
A funny thing that happened though. There was a comedian who did an impression of Jay early. Because we can all do, I'm like third generation Jay Leno.
Third generation.
We all got that. You know, it's like, you know, once somebody breaks it and then you can figure out how to do it.
Everybody has it.
So there was a guy who did an early impression of Jay, and what he did back then, remember there was like a comedy magazine or a comedy list of when your mm-hmm. spots would so if you were you know like Jay Leno or Jerry Seinfeld, you could buy a whole page, which is like, you know,
just for laughs newspaper.
Yeah, so you can, and then they would promote, and it would hand it out to the different comic book, say, you know, and he's playing this auditorium civic center, and
Jerry was another one way ahead of us.
And like they were pretty promoting and big, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. And so, but what happened was there was a comedian who saw where Jay was playing, so he would call up and say, yeah, this is Jay. I'm doing your gig, and you know, it's got one thing though. When I show up at the airport, you're gonna have to have 25,000 in cash. me at the airport when you pick me up. And so Jay would fly to this place, and they go, Jay, here, thanks for coming, and here's your cash. You go, what do you want with this? He said, it's $25,000 you asked for. I didn't ask for $25,000. What are you talking about? Who answered? I'm not. And it's like, and he said, and then he would go to another place, you know, and the guy would call ahead and say, listen, yeah, he said, yeah, yeah, before I need to,
oh my God, that's,
you're going to have I need the $25,000
so
in a brown paper bag, and you have it at the airport. You got to do it, or I'm not going to do the gig. And so the guy would show up, hey, Jay, I need $25,000. What is this? $25,000. What, $25,000? Yes, Jay, you asked her, you know, $25,000 a brown paper bag. It's a, I didn't ask, what the hell's going on here?
Let me tell you what you want.
It's Japanese cars.
I got to go down here.
And so what he did was he finally figured out what was going on here. So he called and said, listen, if you get the guy, he calls up and says he's me, just get his number. And then he got his number, this comedian.
Uh-oh.
Who was doing it. And then he found out the guy's name. And when he, and the best part of the story, he was going to, he was auditioning for Jim McCauley for The Tonight Show. Mm, he said, let me know when he's going on. So before they bring him up, Jay said, let me just go up and do some time. So Jay goes up.
There goes Jay.
Does 45 minutes of his killer shit at the Comedy Magic Club before this guy goes on, mm-hmm. and blows out the room.
Yeah. Yep.
And Jay could blow out any room he wanted, and blew it out till there's just nothing left. And then this guy went on after and just ate it. Didn't get the show.
Wow. I plead guilty in 78 after Mork and Mindy. I did a couple, you know. Hello, this is Robin. I need $1 million cash at the next one.
Bring it to Dana Carvey's house.
And then you get, gotta have I need $1 million.
Her? No, this is DraftKings.
Stockholder, just a disclosure, I own DraftKings shares.
You don't own all of it, do you?
I wetted my beak. I took a taste.
I did a party for this guy at Gillette Stadium for his wife's birthday. Mm. And I did my crummy stand-up act. In full disclosure. I play DraftKings when I do fantasy football, so I do have it. Rewind it back to the days of chillaxing on the beach and all day fun with spring break on DraftKings Casino. Play exclusive games like fan fave Rocket. The excitement is endless, the vibes are right, and the cash prizes
could be huge.
You like money? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Dan, do you like money?
Oh, I don't know. I could take it or leave it, but I like DraftKings, I'll tell you that much.
Some people don't like money. If you don't like money, don't play. New players, start playing with just $5 and get $100 back instantly in casino credits. Download the app and use code FOTW to book your one-way ticket to fun with DraftKings Casino. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Listen up, Dana. Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.1800gambler.net. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. 21 plus.
Physically present in Connecticut, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia only. Void in Ontario. Eligibility and other restrictions apply. One per opted-in new customer. $5 wage required max. $100 in casino credits awarded, which require one-time playthrough within 168 hours. See terms at casino.com, DraftKings.com/promos. Restrictions apply.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone? You have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Oh, yes, you heard me right. You can talk to an actual human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I just want to mention a few names
before we get
of our pals, and you can join in because they're listening to this from the old San Francisco. Of course, the great Bobby Slayton, Mike Pritchard, Jake Johansson, Milt Abel, Larry Bubbles Brown, Mark Pitta, Bob Sarlop, Mark McCollum, and many, many more that came up in that early scene with us.
Let me see that list. Robin
Williams was the godfather of that scene.
Robin Williams was such, I mean, before the internet, before, you know, cell phones, Robin would show up at like the... at the Holy City Zoo, and then people on the street would hear about it, and the next thing you know, it's packed. People would be running to get in there.
Yeah, for
sure. Then he'd do an hour at least.
Oh, yeah.
And then he'd leave, and if the drunk people had stayed, then we'd have an audience. And so more times than not, they would be the audience would come to see him, and hopefully he'd show up. And more times than not, he did. Because he was just addicted to it, and then and loved it, and so we had a scene thanks to him. There was like at one point
comedy scene
on one street, on one block, there were three places to do stand up.
Who's that?
Last Day Saloon had it on like Mondays or
on
whatever.
Clement.
Holy City Zoo, Clement Street, and Sixth and Clement. And then there was a place across the street that would do it on like Tuesdays.
Yeah.
A bar, you know?
We were there pre-clubs. The first club got built in 79, proper club. That was the punchline.
The punchline. That was like a real, when you did that, they paid you $25, a little bit more than that.
That was amazing.
Sarlot. Sarlot had like a real job in show business.
Bob Sarlot.
He was like on TV, which is like incredible.
Entertainment Tonight.
He was a sidekick for Letterman on Letterman's morning
show. On the morning show. That was like ridiculous. But he had like would do spots on TV and was always smooth and a totally professional guy.
Yeah, great.
Kind of like
comic.
Had that kind of the charisma of like a Leno who would just settle in. The audience could be totally relaxed watching him. And then Slayton would murder and do really edgy, edgy material that like and get away with it and just get to the point where the audience is pushing back and dance around it and make jokes off not apologizing for it. And that was a really like very instructive way. And he would destroy a room. Like literally, like in that I said. Well, you have to learn what like a headliner is. You have to learn what an MC is, what like a middle act. And you see Dana Carvey is like, well, that's a superstar. But then you see Bobby Slayton,
solid headliners.
Bobby Slayton was a solid headliner. Is going to work everywhere. And that's what you got to do. But that wasn't my style because my style was more off-standing and uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Some of those.
So I was good for 20.
Arizona.
I would be good for 10, 15, 20. Was interesting and different. Bring the audience to me. But that's not a headliner. Headliner, you got to go out and you got to pummel, and that's different. Yeah.
But in the last 15 years, when you've come back to stand up, you've done several specials. You've done great. You know
that
you've
then
become
you
a
have
great
to,
great stand up.
You have to change and adapt because you also have to adapt to what their expectations are.
Yeah,
once you're famous,
they see you're famous. Copy machine, or whatever.
They've seen your movies
and also all the movies. Let's see, we mentioned them quickly.
I was going to say if we're going to wrap up Precious San Francisco, you also did
SF.
Arizona didn't get much play in this one.
Larry Bubbles Brown. These guys didn't move to L.A. That was the problem.
Yeah, and they became San Francisco treats. You know, like famous. San Francisco comics.
Know them.
But you have to make the sacrifice and come down and eat shit for a while and audition for 1,000. But a lot of people's like, they didn't want to mess with how comfortable things were.
I never understood that, making that your thing. Because I think it was Rick Overton who said, hey, the cameras are down there, buddy.
You know, that's funny.
Let's go to where the cameras are.
Yeah. You have to.
Rich Scheidner. Hey, it says here you dated Julia Sweeney. I don't remember that.
No. Okay. I don't know why that stuff like that gets on the internet. It's like, I would never.
You had a phrase called, you can do it. Is that true?
Well, I didn't understand that. Adam asked me to be in one of his early movies. He asked me to be in to play the part that Ben Stiller did in Happy Gilmore. And he said, because of this playing
you
this
and Adam
anger.
Have a chemistry, and David, you guys are part of that world.
There was
with
a
Adam.
Thing where like buddy. There was a comfort level where like, and I finally told Adam, I said, listen. I said, stop. He said, you got to put other famous people in these movies. You don't need, and I said, you don't need to hire me for that. I'm telling you, you could hire Nick Nolte. And he finally did. And now he's not hiring me. He took me up on it. But hire people and do these other, you know. And but
you beat the shit out of that. That's what I mean, doing a great thing with that phrase.
A rhythm. So the thing was, he said, there's one line and you could do it. And it's,
and you can do it.
And it was actually Herlihy who came up with it. And I said, well, what does it mean? He said, just come out, we'll figure it out. It's a rhythm thing. And I'll go like, all right. So we went out and it was a sing-songy thing of just a guy showing up.
Yeah.
The fun of the audience knowing that there's some back history with Adam.
Yeah, something's happening in the movie.
And it was and I said, I'll find a way to do it. And just do it in different ways. And they, you can do it. So it was it was just goofy. It didn't make sense. It was a guy who is not. It was
inexplicable. That's why it lasts. Inexplicable jokes like chopping broccoli or you can do it. Just go on for decades.
It doesn't, because it's something that it doesn't need to be performed that way. It doesn't, no one in the history of the world would say it that way. Yeah. It's not necessary.
It's unnecessary.
It's not to say it.
It's five questions. Who is that guy? What is he doing there? How did he get there? When did he come up with his catchphrase? Why is he yelling it? When you can get to five questions, that's a keeper.
And auditions,
yelling a celebrity yelling a shit joke.
Yeah.
Robbie,
what's the shit joke?
The joke is like, I got chunks of guys like you in my stool.
Oh, there you go. Phil Hartman.
The three. But the five, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. So that was like, and let's do it in different ways. And he kept, Adam had a genius thing of like, he would keep the audience, they'd always get a laugh in there. And even when it was like a serious part and like the water boy, when he's upset and he throws a baseball out the window and it hits the Kentucky Fried Chicken kernel. And it got a laugh and carried them out of that scene.
Yeah.
So he really knew how to, you know, keep the laughs going in there.
Absolutely.
Pummeling.
You go into auditions, and then, like, when we were doing movies and you would have people come in for auditions, we're on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. We're casting people.
Yeah.
And when everyone does a line the same way, and then someone does, you can do it, you go, oh. And then you go, have them come back. Because that stands out. If you're not going to give it the most perfect reading that everyone's going to give, there's something to that. This April, reality TV hits a new high on Hulu from executive producer Jimmy Kimmel. The all-new Hulu original series High Hopes premieres on, of course, 4/20, just in time for your viewing pleasure.
The Hulu original reality series follows two budding entrepreneur brothers and their hilarious half-baked employees at one of the fastest-growing cannabis dispensaries in Hollywood.
This workplace comedy showcases the highs and even more highs of the competitive marijuana industry.
More than just co-workers, the owners and bud tenders in High Hopes are one dope family.
You'll fall in love with these quirky characters as they pursue career aspirations, love, and fame, all under a slightly hazy cloud.
Mark your calendar for 4/20 to get into the new reality series, High Hopes, streaming only on Hulu.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/wall to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/wall. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
You got to bring something to it.
Yeah,
that's
you bring
not
something
on the page.
Different. Yeah.
Bring something on the page.
Comedy
like when we
is
did the
surprise.
Wrong Missy. There was nothing in that. I mean, truthfully, there's nothing in that role in Wrong Missy.
Wrong Missy for you.
Nothing. But yeah. Even Adam called me and said, nah, I don't want you, this is role, but it's not big enough. You don't need to do it. It's there's nothing.
Oh, what was
you
the helped. Character were that in Wrong Missy?
He asked
the
me.
Shark guy.
That was funny.
He asked me to like to do this thing, and then he called me up at the last minute and go, like, we really want you to do this. And I said, okay, yeah. I'll do it. And I said, but it's my wife's birthday. He said, nah, just bring her. And so we ended up, my wife came and she was happy to go to Hawaii. And it was a fun gig because I'm just showing up doing a small role.
Yeah.
At a small time.
You always score with
me. Everyone's happy to have you there.
Yeah.
Because you're just coming in to score.
Yeah. You were scoring.
And then, and I said, well, let me figure this out. And I called Sandler. I said, what if I do it as an Aussie guy? And I, you know, you're going to go like, man, I don't want to play that. And he said, no. And you know when Adam is like, no.
What are you doing?
You know, just do the, you know, he's already,
just fucking do it.
He was stretched. Just do the fucking goddamn. What are you just like, you know, yeah, all right.
We love you, Adam.
And so, but then you got to find the thing. And I said, well, if you start crazier to beginning in the beginning of the scene, and then you got a place to really go. If you were crazy, and I said, get me sunburned and ever. And I was like, overweight and burned and fat and bald. And I said, this is going to be great.
Snyder always commits to that shit.
Yeah, and they gave me a hand that was missing a few fingers. And I said, a young director's, you know, you be gentle with the young directors, but you also have to like, you can't listen 100% because they, you know, if you've done 30 movies in, you go, I really think this is a better idea. Then because he said like, when you see that shark down there, you tell him, you know, and his line, you tell him I'm going to I'm gonna get it. You know, the attitude was to be angry. And I thought, well, let's do the opposite of that. You know, and I said, okay,
just put the camera on. Keep it a nice shot.
I said, well, when you see that shark down there, you tell him, what's up? As if he's like happy to see him again, even though he ate my hand. Yeah. And it's just funnier. And it's a rhythm that you don't expect.
It's positive. It's always good to go there.
And it's when the guys get eaten by a shark, I said, you got to cut back up to us dancing.
Mm-hmm. That was a
disco
great one.
Song. And yeah. So you just got to do it. And he said, but we don't have time.
I was the
and
guy
said, just
getting
give me one take. I said, David's in the shark tank on the boat.
I want to hear him.
And I said, we don't have music. We don't have time for the money. We don't have music. And I said, let me talk to my music guy and I'll give you a piece in 30 minutes. That'll be free.
Just,
That'll be, so I called my,
that's awesome.
I called my composer, John Hunter, in Austin. I said, dude, can you just give me a fame? I'm doing this movie. It's Happy Madison. David Spade's the star. We just need a disco song that they can just have for free.
You, Farley, Swartz, and just are dancing and playing against me getting eaten by a shark.
Yes. And he said, well, we only have time for one take. I said, I'll take it.
Yeah, take it.
So he did the one with the crane coming up while we're dancing to this disco song while you're underneath the water. And he said, it's something to cut to. You're going to want it.
Yeah.
If we don't have time, just do it. So we got one.
Yeah.
And that's what they use. So that's what you kind of hope for.
Well, worth it.
But what voice did you settle on? I saw the movie.
They wouldn't let me do a sorry, what I ended up doing was like a really low
Robert Shaw
kind of guy. Well, they didn't want to do Robert Shaw.
What I wanted to do is
a guy who's an alcoholic and great, you know, gravelly voice and low. To be opposite of you.
Yeah.
Because that was interesting. And then I had nothing really there. So you just create, so what do I got? I said, I'm the diving instructor. This is my boat. This is my fucking boat. I'm in charge of the boat. I said, give me some stuff. And the prop guy said, what do you need? I said, give me the snorkel and the respirator. So does it need to work? Said, of course it needs to work. Give me the goddamn thing. And he said, please turn it on. Give me something to do. And so I started playing with it while between takes. I said, what's funny? And it was making noise.
Yeah.
And
funny noise. Noise.
Yeah. And so we just, and David so and I were working together.
It's part of the rhythm. It's like a vape pen.
We were
rhythm.
Fucking laughing.
Yeah. Right? So it's, and so I got this thing and all of a sudden
going back and forth. I go back
and so and, what, and he's about to get into the water and as he's walking I'm walking with him with this thing it's and I put and it's so right before I putting it on him and spraying it the water and then I put it in my mouth and then I hand it to him.
You got everything.
And David it's like I'm now supposed to put that in my mouth
and David would play that
and I knew he'd go with it. I remember
we were rehearsing that and I go Rob because it was so funny I go do it more and so you were going like lick, and I'm just staring at you, and then you finally go, and then you stick it, and you go, and I put that in my mouth. Okay.
Yeah, but that got us out of that scene.
Yeah, it was
big
so
laugh
funny.
To get to
Great.
The next
funny
thing.
With the sound off.
Yeah.
You know, just it that's so all weird. Funny, and did it do eight?
Funny with
eight,
the sound off.
100 billion minutes, or how many
55
minutes?
55 million views that first month, and then still top 10
go by
in history.
Minutes, so like a billion minutes
I don't know.
Of
back
watching.
Then it wasn't minutes. It was just...
But that was the thing.
Global
you know,
smash.
Funny with the sound turned off.
Yes.
We had an acting coach, Ivana Chubbuck.
Yeah, she really helped.
That's huge.
Roy London was the first one. And then when he passed away, Ivana Chubbuck took over. And she would say, do the scene again, but without the words. So everyone knows from your physicality what's happening.
Yeah.
Because that you're communicating with your body, aren't you?
Yeah.
You should be.
That's I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
That's the grapes.
She would also tell us, use a lot of props. Really work the room. Like, it's more fun if you're doing business.
Get
and you're doing
stuff.
That. And that's hard to do because you're acting. You got to remember your lines. You got to match
but
everything.
Get it. Get the stuff. Great. And like for Deuce Bigelow, the thing about that was like.
Deuce Bigelow.
My favorite thing about that, I was flying to Australia to promote the movie. And I'd never flown anywhere to promote anything. Mm. So this is like the first starring role in any movie where I was the guy on the poster. It's like, it's cool to be on the poster and there's a billboard of you.
Yeah.
And it was.
Yeah.
And I thought, wait, let's just have a big name. It was Walt Disney Company did it, and it was for Joe Roth. And I said, this is a funnier thing. It's like me naked on the side of a bus, you know, like the Burt Reynolds thing. And I was in really good shape back then. I said, this would be funny. And I said, no. And they said a very interesting thing. They said, posters are to not lose people. Don't give people a reason to not want to go see it.
Give them any edge on
and
that.
I said, holy crap. And so I'm flying to Australia because the movie did really good in America, you know, and then... you hear this laughter. It's hard to hear anything on a plane, but you hear this booming laughter on a plane. And I go back there and they were watching my movie without the sound because they didn't want to see, you had to spend money to get movies back then.
Really good sign.
Yes.
Really good
I
sign.
Said, this is going to do really good everywhere. Yeah. Because but they didn't pay the $10. They're just watching the movie because they can understand it by the physicality because that's the way you're
And you can
trained.
Laugh harder when it's funny with the sound off. You're not waiting for punchlines. It's yeah. just that you can just relax.
And and sometimes when you're doing things and they don't, it's really funny. And then they could ruin it with sound. There was a Men Behaving Badly TV series. The funniest thing I did in the whole series was very frustrating because the English show was so funny. It's the only reason I agreed to do it.
A sitcom, just do the same thing.
Sitcom on NBC. Mm-hmm. And they instead of making it just doing the same episodes that they did in England, they watered them down as like men apologizing badly. But there was one really funny thing where I said I'm going to get attacked by an owl. And it was in the way back and they're foreground, and I'm just in the background while there's people in the front, which is that's hilarious.
Yeah,
because you could be the funny. Mm-hmm. They said, "Well, what do we have? We can't have a real owl." And I said, "Just get a stuffed owl. Just get something, and I'll pretend it's attacking to me."
Yeah. Yeah.
So I grabbed the beak right here, and it did this, and I'm spinning around, and I'm going out of frame, coming back in, coming through. Mm-hmm. I'm hitting it, and that was the and then they put and it was the funniest thing I had done on that show. And then they put like when they came on the air. The cowardly producers decided to put in squawk, 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 which killed it.
Yeah.
Because it brought too much attention to it. Yeah. But I ended up redoing that for another movie, basically that idea of the far background and going back with an animal.
That's the essence of comedian trying to be in movies and wanting to control the rhythm. And Sandler told me early on after his success, he goes, Carvey, they don't. Meaning the directors. He did a couple of movies where Adam didn't get to be Adam. He goes, they don't know what they're doing, Carvey.
Yeah.
They don't really know. It's not their fault. They don't know where to put the camera or whatever. So that kind of triggers me a little bit because I had experiences just like that.
Because that's a survival mechanism. You know what?
Yeah.
You got to be.
Yeah, we know the funny part. Just let us do that. So
and then if you get anybody who's going to be a director, and they usually put us with commercial directors because they know where to put the camera, know how to work, and they know a schedule and blah, blah, blah.
But they
also have the ego of like, no, let's do it my way.
Right.
And then you go, but this is what I wrote.
Well, Penelope Spheris in Wayne's World 1 was my best director because I'd have a Garth thing and she'd go, what are you going to do here? And I'd show her. And her only direction was, could you do it 10 seconds faster? That was it. No other direction.
But that's actually good because
I already had the character.
And the thing is about doing it faster and cutting out the pauses is instructive.
That's fine. I can do it a little shorter.
I used to hate when Dennis Dugan would say, can you do it without the pauses? Can you just do it without the pauses? Just do it tighter than without the pauses. And I said, can't you just cut it that way? And he said, what if I don't want to cut it? And then he's right.
Yeah, because a single shot is best, ideally, unless the edit is a comic. Well,
that was
point.
The thing, like John Cleese, such a my hero and like...
Genius.
Genius. And he said, look at the scene in Life of Brian, also voted as the number one comedy of all time in England. You bastardize our language, but for English, the traditional. Anyway, it's all. And he said, this is the number one. This is the voted, not by me, of course, but by people who, the public. So anyway, so he said, look at the scene when Michael Palin and the guards are going in to, don't let anyone in, blah, 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 and unless it's him. And and it's the guards. And they said, let anyone in. No. Don't let anyone in, no matter what. And it's a very intricate thing.
Yeah.
But it's a single master shot.
Yeah.
And it requires a lot more rehearsal, but it's worth it. Let the audience decide where they want to look. Because so much of direction in television direction, and we're in an era of television.
Digital cutting.
Just cut here, let them look at this. Cut here, look at them. Do this movie. I don't really speak Spanish that well, but I just directed a film in Mexico, and the editor, who's a great guy, but he cuts to this and then punch in on this, and I said, let the audience figure it out. And
two shots are great.
Where they're looking. Wide let the audience decide who they want to look at.
I feel like when I'm watching some stand-up specials, I'm in an invisible flying chair. Like I'm flying in the chair, seeing the guy waist up, and all of a sudden I'm way in the back, and then I'm right up on his face, and just let it breathe.
That
cowboy shot, hold that a lot.
Yeah.
Don't overcut.
That's the most important shot for stand-up in those specials.
I don't know who couched it. Was it Steve Allen? I mean, it just became the classic shot to give a monologue on a talk show.
The audience has to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
They have to be comfortable with you and with them. Mm-hmm. And if they're, what I always tell them in movies, it's like, and I tell this then because I was just working with a great crew in Mexico. And I said, listen, I said, here's the thing. And I would tell the first AD, and I, you know, because we were getting along in days. And I said, you know what people never say? I got to go see that new movie. I heard it was on time. You know, I got it. Yeah. And I tell the cinematographer who wanted to do this shot. And, I said, you know what they never hear? You never hear an audience, the people say, like, I got to go see that new movie. I hear the camera moves are excellent.
I heard it came in under budget. All right, Rob, thanks for coming by. I guess that's loved it.
Rob Schneider, all-time great on SNL, huge cultural influence in American comedy.
Fake movies
in the last 30 years, and just really shared a lot of great times with this young man. David, we're friends, right?
Yeah.
I like all my youngsters. I'm so proud of both of you.
Thank you. We hope we made you proud.
All right, Rob.
Thanks, Robert.
Peace out. Be well.
This has been a podcast presentation of Cadence 13. Please listen, then rate, review, and follow all episodes. Available now for free wherever you get your podcast.
No joke, folks.
Fly on the Wall has been a presentation of Cadence 13, executive produced by Dana Carvey and David Spade, Chris Corcoran of Cadence 13, and Charlie Finan of Brillstein Entertainment.
The show's lead producer is Greg Holtzman, with production and engineering support from Serena Regan and Chris Basil of Cadence 13.